The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Bryce Clem with an episode from the Lawfare Archives for December 26th, 2021. I picked an episode from October 2015 in which a panel discusses the NSA's surveillance reforms post-Edward Snowden. The panel features Lawfare's Benjamin Wittes, former NSA director, General Michael Hayden, Robin Simcox of the Henry Jackson Society, and Laura Donahue of Georgetown Law.
I'm Cody Poplin, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, October 17th, 2015. That was the voice of none other than Benjamin Wittes, Lawfare's co-founder and editor-in-chief. Last week, the Center for Strategic and International Studies hosted Ben, along with Laura Donahue of Georgetown Law, former NSA Director Michael Hayden, and Robin Simcox of the Henry Jackson Society, to discuss the future of surveillance reform in a post-Snowden world. What have we learned about NSA surveillance activities and their oversight mechanisms since June 2013? In what way should U.S. intelligence operations be informed by their potential impact on U.S. economic interests? And domestically, has the third-party doctrine outlived its applicability? Tom Carrico of CSIS moderated the panel. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode number 143, Surveillance Reform After Snowden.
National Security Program at CSIS. And we've got really a great conversation today about intelligence reform post the Snowden era. And we're going to change the lineup, I think, slightly from what's on the panel. Why don't we have General Hayden go first? Of course, former director of CIA and NSA, as well as many other things. And then I think I'll have Ben Wittes. Senior fellow, of course, of governance studies at the Brookings Institution, editor-in-chief of my favorite blog, Lawfare. And Laura Donahue is a professor of law at Georgetown Law, director of the Center on National Security and Law, and the director of the Center on Privacy and Technology. Are you director of anything else that's left off? And finally, playing cleanup, Robin Simcox, who is a research fellow of the Henry Jackson Society, and has a new report out on surveillance after Snowden. I think he's going to be joining us in D.C. This side of the pond here soon. So why don't we start off, General Hayden, with giving us some initial thoughts.
Sure. So let me offer perspective that might be a little bit different from my colleagues. We are quickly going to be jumping into specifics. But, you know, should you do this? Should you not do that? Is this still warranted? Does this still meet the reasonable definition, reasonableness definition in the Fourth Amendment? You should have been in the green room. We'd already started the scrum about different issues. But let me enter the problem through a slightly different window, and that's not what we decide is reasonable or unreasonable. What we decide is lawful or unlawful. What we decide is appropriate or inappropriate. But how we decide. And I think that actually is the fundament thing that is changing. Okay? So when the 215 program is made public, that's the metadata issue, the bulk data that's accessed occasionally by NSA and so on. When that was made public, I think the government and the National Security Agency, to use a phrase probably more familiar to Robin, was on its back foot about the whole thing. Actually, it was probably back in another part of its body, but it wasn't responding very well to this. And it was because they were taken off guard. And let me just articulate the case from the NSA's point of view and to describe for you what the issue of how we decide is I think, the core issue. So NSA comes out of the Church Pike era. And when I was actually directed by President Bush to begin the predecessor of the 215 program under his authority, I mean, I actually said to the president, Mr. President, NSA, since the 1970s, has a permanent one ball, two strike count against it. We don't take any close pitches. Right? And what I was referring to was coming out of Church Pike and the real and imagined abuses of that era and the era right in front of it. And then the structure that we set up, the process that we set up in order to make these decisions, good, bad, reasonable, unreasonable, appropriate, inappropriate. And the process we set up was to take something that frankly had always been almost exclusively within the province of the executive, espionage, right, and spread it out over the other branches of government. And you know, when we get to process questions later, we need to remember that we Americans have spread this out over other branches of government more than any other Western democracy. Our Congress and courts are more empowered to oversee American espionage than any other parliamentary or court system in the world. So the grand compromise was that although it largely remained within the power of the executive, you created two standing committees in Congress. Right? You had a House Permanent Select Committee and a Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, and the law is pretty clear, fully and currently informed. Now, we'll probably talk about how hard that is, particularly from the congressional point of view, because this is a lot of stuff, and none of it's simple. But the law is fully and currently informed. And then we created a court system, albeit a secret court, to oversee it. I was in Germany for the Munich Security Conference. I mentioned the FISA court, and someone from the darkness, this was a panel at 10:30 at night. It was literally in the bar of the hotel, but it was on the schedule. And I said the FISA court, and a German-accented voice in English comes out of the darkness and says, a very unusual court indeed. And I said, yes, indeed, it's unusual. Not because it's secret, but because it is. Other democracies do not put these kinds of questions under the judiciary. So now you've got the 215 program, authorized by not one but two presidents, and you know, following along closely since we all live in D.C., kind of different personalities, but both presidents had authorized the program. It had been legislated in Congress, and I know we can debate about the fine print about what people did or didn't know, but it was in statute in the Patriot Act, and then it was overseen by the federal court system. So NSA is chugging along with 215 saying, I got the Madisonian trifecta going on here. I've got the executive, I got the legislative, I got the court. How much better can this be? I have done it exactly the way you guys said we had to do it coming out of the kerfuffle of the 1970s. And as it turned out, a lot of our countrymen didn't think that constituted consent of the governed. And here I'm not talking about a radical fringe or people with tinfoil on their head. An awful lot of solid-thinking Americans, because of a shift in our political culture, described what I just described to you not as consent of the governed, but perhaps consent of the governors. Put another way, you may have told them, but you didn't tell me. And an awful lot of really calmly thinking Americans raise the issue as to whether the Grand Compromise of the 1970s was the way they would choose to approve edgy espionage activities in the future. Now that is, I think, the fundamental question that we have in front of us. We can decide on metadata and incidental collection and inadvertent collection. You know, those are important questions. But the critical one is, how do we decide these questions in a way that most Americans feel that the answer has genuine legitimacy? This is going to be hard, all right? Covert action by plebiscite is an impossibility. And so how do we preserve enough secrecy and espionage, which relies on secrecy to be successful, and yet create enough openness and transparency that most Americans say, I'm comfortable with that and I'm happy that it's going on? That, to me, is the core question we have in front of us.
Thank you. Ben?
So thanks very much for having me. I'd like to start, I want to suggest three what I think are core questions that any sort of next phase of intelligence reform are going to have to confront. The first is duplicative of the one that General Hayden just made, but I want to frame it a little bit differently. The 1978 Church-Pike Compromise had a structural logic to it. And the structural logic was, we cannot do the normal forms of democratic oversight with respect to ongoing intelligence activity, because you then reveal the contents of the intelligence being collected as well as the modes of the acquisition. So what we're going to do is we're going to create these institutions within the normal oversight institutions that operate different ways but conduct the same activities. So General Hayden mentioned the FISA court is the one that reviews the legality of the immediate acquisition proposed, right? And it functions the way an Article III court, it is an Article III court, but it functions the way an Article III court normally functions in the context of a wiretap, only it does so without the subsequent disclosure that takes place. Similarly, the intelligence committees in both houses are, proxies for the normal sort of oversight that a congressional committee would have, say the Armed Services Committee would have over the military. Nobody ever thought these mechanisms were perfect. But until relatively recently, they were regarded as adequate, and they were regarded with a certain degree of pride to the extent that people even knew they existed. So I want to frame the question that General Hayden just posed as, do we still believe in the 1978 compromise? Does that logic that you can do the same activities using subsets of institutions that can act with secrecy and with an understanding of the, sometimes quite exigent intelligence community need for secrecy and in a trusted environment? Or do we not any longer believe in that? And are we going to insist on a more populist vision of intelligence oversight? And if the latter, what does that look like? I think so that's fundamental question number two. One. Fundamental question number two, there is a wonderful old Gary Larson Far Side cartoon, some of you above a certain age will remember, entitled How Birds See the World. And it is an aerial view of an urban landscape in which all of the people and dogs have targets over their heads. Now, this could easily be renamed How the Intelligence Community Sees Overseas Non-U.S. Persons, right? There's a name in the intelligence community for non-U.S. persons overseas, and it's targets or potential targets. Now, when the Snowden revelations broke, the intelligence community and President Obama, and all quite reasonably in my view, responded by saying, hey, look, we have these incredible protections for U.S. persons. We have all of these judicial review mechanisms. We have congressional oversight. And it's all designed, look, we have these U.S. persons need not feel threatened by any of this, unless you're engaged as an agent of a foreign power. And guess what? All of that was right, by the way. And guess what? It didn't matter if you happened to be German that the U.S. has all these wonderful protections for U.S. persons. If you happened to be Brazilian, this was not especially reassuring. And the significance of this, to my mind, is immense. If you look at Presidential Decision Directive 28, the reform directive that Obama issued, it acknowledged for the first time in the history of intelligence in the world that the non-national of the intelligence acquisition activity overseas has privacy interests that the intelligence community has to recognize in some sense. Now, how much PDD 28 really, how much it affects anything is a complicated set of technical questions. But what's not a complicated set of technical questions is the following. Everybody agrees now to some degree that that model where foreigners overseas are just the targets, right? Like how birds see the world. We're moving away from that to some degree. We're acknowledging, and this is, of course, what the European Court of Justice opinion this week was about, right? We seem to be acknowledging that there is some degree of privacy interest worldwide that our activity implicates that we acknowledge. Now, this is a very, very profound change. And the question is, to put it crudely, are we serious about that? And I think this is going to be a huge undercurrent of the next phase of debate. And the reason, quite simply, is that 95% of the world, which the intelligence community looks at and sees targets, and Facebook and Google look at and they see customers. And industry does not look at those communities and say, it's fine for there to be open season on the rest of the world as long as US persons' privacy is protected. And so I think the second big question is, what obligations, if any, does US intelligence owe to the privacy of everybody else in the world? And does that operate with no consideration of reciprocity, which is to say, what obligations does Chinese intelligence owe to US persons or the FSB owe to US persons? Finally, when I raise this issue, people often look at me like I'm insane. And I want to start by saying I'm entirely serious. There's no component of the following that is a joke. We are going to have to confront what happens as we all become more cyborg-like than we currently are, and what that means, what the cyborgization of the human species is going to mean for our view of metadata. Many of you are wearing medical monitoring devices on your wrists. We call them, jawbone or something that occurs biodata about yourself, a Fitbit. Some of you may have a pacemaker. That produces a lot of data that can be collected from outside. We think of data as, limited by, produced by your phone. Right? But data is not produced just by phones. It's produced by all kinds of electronic objects with which we engage. Traditionally, we would describe that material as metadata, and we would describe it's non-content information, right? It's just what your heart's doing. It's just your pulse, right? It's not what you've said to somebody else in a communication. And we would traditionally regard it under Smith v. Maryland as material that you voluntarily disclosed to a third party. Now, you may have voluntarily consented to have that pacemaker put in when you were in cardiac arrest, but you didn't have to, right? And it's being given to some company that operates your pacemaker for you. The more integrated we get with technology, the more data we are producing of a non-content variety, the more unsatisfying the division between metadata and content data is going to seem. The more you are a cyborg, the less you are a pure bio-human, the less sense it makes to make a sharp division between metadata and content data. So I want to suggest that question number three, and I will stop here, is as we become more integrated with technology, that is, our human existence becomes more integrated with technology, if you accept as a working premise that the collection of a lot of metadata is not going to proceed under normal warrant standards. What is the basic rule going to be for the collection of stuff that isn't, you know, voice or email communications, but can be very, very personal and isn't being collected from us? It's being collected from entities with which we choose to do business. So I'll stop there. Three kind of big picture questions with no attempts at answers to.
Okay, so actually I'll pick up there because I agree with you about this, about the change technologies. More of what we say and do is online and recorded and digitized. And because it's digitized, it means that it can be accessed, it can be analyzed, it can be shared, it can be combined with other information than ever before. So we live in a new world, and one in which networks have converged. So before, if we wanted to do foreign intelligence, we could put specific military systems, for instance, under surveillance, but it didn't affect the rest of us, so to speak. But now, with the internet, it does. And so technology has radically transformed this world, where we go, what we do, who we are with when we do it. All of this information is now recorded, it can be accessed, and these networks have converged. What we've seen in addition, that I think the Snowden documents really showed, is that at the same time, we've seen a lowered barrier to access to foreign intelligence information for the United States government. And these phenomena, I think, have really converged along with outmoded legal doctrines like third-party data, reliance on geography in the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, that these have all converged to bring us to the point in time when the Section 215 telephony metadata program and the 702 FAA collection program and certain discussions about Executive Order 12333 have really pushed this into the public discussion. So I've written quite a bit about the legality and constitutionality of those programs. What I'd like to focus on today is what we should do about it, because the problem really, I feel a bit like Plato's allegory of the cave, that we've been looking at the shadows on the wall, but there's this fire raging behind us, which is society is changing, technology is changing, and we need to rethink these issues, how we approach them, if we really do care about individual rights moving forward. And so what I'd like to suggest are three things that we should think about moving forward from here as a way to actually address these problems that have now presented themselves. The first is more robust oversight. The second is to distinguish more clearly between criminal law and national security. Those two fields have become intermingled at the great cost of individual rights in the United States. And third is to look at our existing legal doctrine and to alter it, both the statutory and our constitutional interpretation, to take account of a digital world. So first on more robust oversight. When everybody, after the Snowden documents came out, people started talking about, oh, we need more oversight. And I was reminded of a paper, still the greatest academic titled paper. I know that's a low bar, but there was a paper that Scott Sagan, who's a professor of political science at Stanford, wrote in 2004 when he looked at the Challenger space shuttle disaster and he looked at nuclear reactors in India and ways in which the more protections you build into systems, the less safe they become, because a form of social shirking occurs. You can't say that too many times too fast, right? And what happens is the more protections you build in, the less responsibility people take to kind of call people on the problem. And he called the paper the problem of the redundancy problem, which I always thought was great. So when people said we need more oversight, I thought, oh gosh, that is not what we need. You know, we have the IG of the Department of Justice and the agency have to review compliance under targeting and minimization and report them every year. Twice a year, the Attorney General and the Director of National Intelligence have to report on 702 compliance to the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, to the Senate Intelligence Committee, to the House Intelligence Committee, to both of the Judiciary Committees, to everybody. The Attorney General and DNI have to actually provide the IG reports to the congressional committees. Every 6 months, the Attorney General has to inform the congressional committees of FISA Amendments Act 702 certifications, etc. There is a lot of reporting going on. Okay, so what do I mean by more robust oversight? More robust oversight. Well, first, we need to have economics be considered fairly deep within the intelligence structure. You know, the fact that we've lost $140 billion in cloud computing because of what was going on at the NSA, we don't have any statutory members on the NSC who have economic interests. Now, the president can put people on the NSC with economic interests, with the economy's interests, but we need to have a more robust understanding of economic security as part of national security, and at a programmatic level, start having somebody there looking at what's the cost to the U.S. economy of some of the intelligence initiatives that we have underway. We need to have a more robust appointment process for the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. The fact also that only 3 of 17,000 applications to the court had ever been rejected, that's a little bit concerning. But even more concerning is the fact that for 3 years, the NSA was querying a database without reasonable articulable suspicion, as the court had required it to do so. And in response, when the court found out that it had been doing this illegally and unconstitutionally, they let them keep the information and continue collection. So there needs to be some sort of teeth in the measure that if the NSA or others act badly, there is a cost for that. That's a more robust oversight mechanism. The constitutional advocates that the USA Freedom Act are proposing for the court, I think this may also help. The court was not designed in 1978 to do anything else but grant warrants. Just, it was a simple, almost administrative procedure. But over time, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court has started to write decisions, to interpret statutory language, to make new constitutional findings. So there's now, according to the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court of Review, a special needs exception for foreign intelligence. No other court in the United States has found a special needs exception for Fourth Amendment purposes for a warrant. This type of finding by a secret court, I think, should be challengeable by a constitutional advocate and should be appealable to the Supreme Court. There should be more transparency for these rulings. So there are a number of things that you can do to the existing structures without just throwing them out that I think would provide more robust oversight. On the second category, the criminal law foreign intelligence distinction, we have historically tried to keep these separate. So there was something called the primary purpose test, which was really developed in a case called Truong, which dealt with a Vietnamese national and a U.S. citizen. In that case, the court said, look, as long as your primary purpose is foreign intelligence, you can use these looser standards to obtain information under the Foreign Intelligence, what became the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. Truong predated it, but then you have the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. This was just followed by the Department of Justice and by courts that it was understood that if you're going to have weaker standards, then you have to use it for the purpose that you're collecting it for. Now, that changed when the wall came down with the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. This is post 9/11. When the wall came down, this was the set of understandings that said, look, you cannot use FISA to get around the criminal law requirements. Now, however, underneath the law and underneath the court's decisions, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court of Review, you can use FISA when your primary purpose is criminal in nature. So you can use the looser restrictions, the looser standards of FISA to go after ordinary criminal activity. And what we've seen is a plummeting in ordinary Title III applications and an exponential increase in FISA applications during that time. We also see that the FBI, for instance, queries the Section 702 database frequently for totally unrelated criminal activity. We've seen leaks talking about parallel construction, where information obtained from 702 or from overseas collection is then funneled to the DEA or to law enforcement agencies, telling them you have to reconstruct the evidentiary trail so nobody knows that this information came from intelligence. This is deeply problematic for Fourth Amendment purposes. And it's deeply problematic because the Fourth Amendment was introduced to prevent general warrants. A general warrant gives the government the ability to collect information and to use it to look for potential evidence of illegal activity without prior suspicion or prior wrongdoing and without particularization. So by using our intelligence gathering authorities for ordinary crime, we are going against the very reason why we adopted as a country the Fourth Amendment. And so I think a re-separation of those two spheres is absolutely essential. The final area is how we take account of this digital world that Ben was discussing earlier. And I think there are a number of ways to do this. First and foremost is the end of third-party data. The idea that in our legal doctrine, if you give your information to a third party, you no longer have a privacy interest in it, fails to recognize the world in which we now live. Whether it's the Internet of Things, whether it's how we go about our daily correspondence, whether it's the fact that when I get in my car and drive down the street, where I go and who I'm with when I do so is all recorded and accessible, that is all private information. We have new algorithms that the kind of metadata that can be collected and analyzed is on a scale that was just didn't exist in the 1970s when this doctrine came into being. So it's time for the shadow majority on the Supreme Court, which in U.S. v. Jones we see that there is one. It's time for them to step forward and get rid of third-party doctrine. I would, along with that, suggest a use restriction on the Fourth Amendment. I think it's time to recognize that the Fourth Amendment does have room for this, so that if we collect information for foreign intelligence purposes, you cannot then turn around and use it to scan for public health, or to scan for criminal purposes, or to scan for myriad other purposes that the government might have, that there is a use restriction that stems from the privacy interests involved. And along with this, our reliance on geography. As a statutory matter, we've relied on things being inside the United States being given a higher level of protection. Things outside the United States are given a lower level. But in this day and age, if I were to email another panelist, it might go through Paris. Right? It might go overseas. And the fact that it does so, I have no control over whether it does that or not, and even my service provider doesn't, because the internet follows the most efficient route. And so we have to come up with new ways to actually construct more robust privacy protections if we value this moving forward.
Thank you. Well, thank you, Tom, for inviting me. It's great to be here. Great to be back in DC. As Tom mentions, I will be moving here soon, so I'm going to make sure that my comments aren't so controversial that I lose loads of friends before I even arrive in the country. Also, obviously, great to be here speaking as one of the targets Ben mentioned, the non-US targets.
Only when you're overseas.
Anyway, yeah. The Snowden, obviously, the affair is one of the US, but I think certainly fair to say the contagion spread. It spread in a different way, and I hope you'll indulge. I'm going to just discuss from a UK perspective the ways in which the Snowden revelations have had a direct impact on policy and potential reform in this area. The first thing I want to bring up, probably important to know, is that in all the discussion around metadata in the US, there's been a conversation going on in the UK for a few years preceding that regarding communications data, which is broadly analogous to metadata, though not exactly the same, but it's essentially the communications data is the context of the conversation, the who, where, when, and how, but not the content. And rather than there being too much of this data being gathered, actually the government has had a fear for a few years now that the access to it is actually insufficient. That because of the way we're changing the ways we communicate, the ways we're billed by the communication service providers we use, for example, whereas your telephone company had to know who you were calling, when, for how long before in order to bill you, now we're paying directly, it's a prepaid plan. There's not the need to generate that communications data that there was before. So the end result of that, the companies not needing to generate the data, means that intelligence agencies and the police are finding it increasingly hard to access it if they need to reconstruct networks of interest. And this isn't just terrorist networks. It's been one of the things I think is especially interesting watching the Snowden debate play out in the US from afar, is that there is, for understandable reasons, a good deal of focus on terrorism-related issues. In the UK context, that's there, but there's also, when we talk about communications data, it's really important in identifying, for example, suicide risks or threatening callers or child exploitation cases. There's all these areas where communications data has been really important outside the terrorism aspect, and the fear is, from the state's point of view, that they're losing access to this data. The other thing that's been, and I think this is something that's obviously been shared with the US as well, is this divide that seems to have formed between the tech companies on one side and the state on the other. During the research for my report on this issue, a very senior British security official told me that the the biggest impact of the Snowden actions, of all the things that were revealed, were that the technology companies were now disengaging from the security apparatus. There was a lot of concern about this and fixing this relationship. I'll give two specific ways in which this has manifested itself, and one which has a very specific non-US component. So on encryption, for example, the ubiquitous encryption, Apple, Google, Facebook, whoever it may be, WhatsApp, providing the encryption rather than the user having to encrypt the data themselves. There's a very active debate going on at the moment, and I've seen bits and pieces of it in the States as well, regarding the state having backdoor access to these communications. There's a lot of pushback, I think, from the tech industry. There is obviously the fear that if you provide access for one, that means you're providing access for Russia, China, any other adversary, potential cyber criminals. And so there's this debate going on where the government want the tech companies to fix this fundamental problem of not being able to access content data because of encryption, and tech companies at the moment not being able to come up with a solution to it. And I've seen there's been some debate on that, and General Hayden interjected on it as well earlier this week, I think it was. There's also a specific problem when it comes to accessing data that outside the US that I would encourage you to consider. Most of the companies that the UK is, for example, asking for data from, let's say they want to get access to content of a Facebook conversation or some other form of encrypted conversation using a US company. What you've seen happen increase a lot post-Snowden is that if a request is refused for whatever reason, there's been a significant, well, let me put it like this. First of all, that there's been an argument coming from tech companies that actually they're not communication service providers, and so they shouldn't be bound by law in the same way that other communication service providers are. They've been arguing that they're actually software platforms, so they're not obliged to hand over this data. Then the argument goes, well, even if we are a communication service provider, we're based in the US, so we're bound by US law, nothing to do with the UK. And so if we were to pass this on, it would contravene the Wiretap Act, and actually we'd be acting illegally. So the UK government and the security agencies, very, very upset by this, very exercised by the whole thing, are saying, well, your service is being offered in the UK. We wouldn't accept this from any other industry. The pharmaceutical services, financial services, don't get to pick and choose which parts of UK law that they adhere to. And so, again, you have this constant friction that's taking place between, I guess, the Silicon Valley and the British security establishment. And I guess you won't be shocked to learn there's not a huge amount of crossover in the views between Silicon Valley and MI5, 6, and GCHQ. There's been a legislative approach to try and fix some of these issues. April 2014, there was a ruling from the European Court of Justice that data retention in the way it was currently being practiced was a fundamental contravention of people's privacy. This was, again, something which made the UK government very, very nervous. It's another clear post-Snowden knock-on effect. And so they passed emergency legislation last summer, quite controversial legislation in many ways, called the Data Retention and Investigatory Powers Act, DRIPA. And what this bill did was achieve several things. It defined what a communication service provider actually was. So it tried to get around the problem of various tech companies saying they weren't bound by the same laws as others. It made clear that even those communication service providers which hold data abroad and are based abroad are subject to UK law if a warrant is served. And it also required them to retain the communications data for up to 12 months. Despite there's a level of pushback to this, but there's still more that the government wants and feels it needs to do legislatively. There's still no legislation requiring the creation of communications data, which again I would stress is important for all these things related to terrorism, security, child exploitation cases, criminal networks. It really is a fundamental part of our crime fighting and security apparatus. So there's still vast concerns about the access to communications data, and there's certain things like internet browsing, for example, still not being able to be accessed legislatively. So if you're minded to watch these things, there's going to be a great deal more debate in the UK, I think, over the coming months about what the government can actually introduce to prevent this. Another big impact of Snowden is on the questions on whether the law that governs all the UK's interception capabilities is fit for purpose. So the law that the Regulation and Investigatory Powers Act of 2000, which the statutory framework which governs all the UK's interception work, widely seen as convoluted, overly complex. You often hear it cited that as social media didn't exist in 2000 when the Act was enacted, that it must be inherently incapable of dealing with modern communication interception issues. I think that's somewhat of a red herring. RIPPER is relatively old legislation, but it was also drafted to be technologically neutral. So it's more about oversight as opposed to whether it covers the latest app or not. But there has been a couple of really key reviews into this legislation by the Intelligence and Security Committee of Parliament and the independent reviewer of terrorism legislation in the UK. They've both been tasked to look at this, and both have recommended that there needs to be root and branch reform of the entire underpinning of the justification that the state uses to intercept communications. That's a really big consequence of what Snowden has done in getting that on the table. Finally, the oversight question, which we've, as we've heard come up in the US context. One of the big debates in the UK is about the extent to which there has to be judicial oversight over requests for access to not just content, but communications data as well. And there's a real difference at the moment in the UK, we don't have judicial oversight in the same way. And I think that's one of the things as when I was studying the oversight the NSA had, and I compared it to comparable Western democracies, be it France, Canada, Australia, Britain. My sense is that actually the oversight in the US is really strong compared to some of the other issues that, you know, some of the ways that interception regimes are overseen in Europe and in the West. But so the UK has no FISA court equivalent, for example. There's quasi-judicial oversight provided by various commissioners who've had high judicial standing and who report directly to the Prime Minister, but they don't have any enforcement powers and they don't have a direct impact on setting policies. It's basically like an accountant looking at a tax return. He can see whether the tax return's right or not, but he has no impact to set tax policy. So that's led to a lot of criticisms in the UK over the fact that warrants are issued by a Secretary of State, a politician, as opposed to a judge. Again, I think this problem, I recognise the debate around it. I think it can be overstated. There's certainly a problem in the UK with having judges and magistrates trained to a sufficient quality to understand RIPPER and the interception framework. A poorly qualified judge looking at this issue, I don't think is any more valid than a well-trained Secretary of State. Ministers, also it should be remembered, are accountable to voters and accountable to Parliament in a way that judges are not, can apply the diplomatic and political context. An application may be legally sound and therefore theoretically should be approved, but it may not be wise politically and not in the public interest. Also, it's worth remembering that the US and the UK systems are very, very different. There's not really a direct comparison to be made. GCHQ, our NSA equivalent, operates directly under an elected foreign secretary. The NSA is obviously within the Secretary of Defense's remit, but there's also answerable to the DNI. So there's not really, the two systems aren't always perfectly analogous. There's a lot of other things I could go into on this. I would just finish with the comments that, in terms of the public reaction to the Snowden leaks. I think the UK's generally been more relaxed about what's happened, the public response, than the US. Part of this is cultural. When we hear spying, I don't think we necessarily think 1984. We probably think more James Bond. This is one of the few great British institutions left. Don't take James Bond away from us as well. So you have, even though Snowden doesn't poll especially badly, the security services do still poll very well when such polls that take place. But even with this taking place, and the fact that the kind of the lobby, I suppose, calling for reform is small but vocal, the Snowden contagion has definitely spread to the UK. The fact that we're talking of ripping up Ripper or changing the way our oversight works is a sign that no matter the culture in the UK, no matter how what we view the role of state surveillance, these issues were unavoidably shaping the current UK discourse. I'll leave that.
Good. Well, thank you. I've got a lot of questions. I'd like to first of all, pit the panelists against themselves. I think the first question I wanted to use to do that really comes from something that General Hayden, you led off with. You began really by situating this back with the interbranch compromises and the interbranch arrangements. Mm-hmm. And I think, I can't remember if it was you or Ben who formulated the question, do we still believe in that basic compromise? Another way of formulating it, and this, the way I think it's glorious, is that arrangement adequate? And so I think the Federalist Papers called the separation of powers and the particular way in which you did it, inventions of prudence. This isn't something that was written down in John Locke, nor indeed is the various ways in which statutorily we've adapted that to these particular circumstances. So the question, first of all, do we still believe in those basic compromises, or is something substantially more needed? In other words, the basic separation of powers question for the United States.
Sure. Very, very briefly, I do. As Robin points out, and I think Ben suggested, we, by international standards, we have a very invasive system of oversight from both our Congress and from court. The issue I was trying to raise is that our political culture has shifted underneath that, and our political culture is now so committed to transparency that it's calling into question the adequacy of the general population. My personal view, it is indeed adequate. It does balance correctly American security and American privacy and liberty. But that almost doesn't matter. If the broad social contract out there finds that no longer satisfying, then we've got to figure out another way of doing it. What I think I owe to that, or more accurately, what my old community owes to that, is a higher degree of transparency about what it is we do to the broader American public. The shorthand version of that I had was, talk to the public when the press isn't accusing you of something. Right? Get out there in front of the story so people have I use the word transparency, and it's probably not good. I did this at Aspen a year or so ago on a panel, and Mike Leiter, former head of the National Counterterrorism Center, said, I agree with everything Mike said, but that's not the right word. It's translucent, not transparent. Transparent reveals too many operational details. Translucent allows the general public to see the broad shapes and movements that are going on within the espionage community, reviewed in detail by the still extant oversight bodies. That's probably where we need to be. Now, let me add just one additional note from somebody with my background. That will shave points off of operational effectiveness. That is an inevitability. That will happen. But I'm telling you, done well, I think that's a thoroughly acceptable choice as long as we all recognize what it is we're doing. All right? We are marginally reducing capacity and capability, and in return, building up, I would hope, not marginally, public confidence in in what we're doing. The alternative to that, if I'm right about the political culture, is we stop doing it. And that would be destructive, not just of American security, but of American liberty, because frightened, endangered people don't make good Democrats.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Other comments on that?
Yeah.
Basic adequacy?
So this, you know, this isn't a new question, right? The founders faced this. This was James Otis's oration in Paxton's case, one of the most famous orations in U.S. history. And John Adams, our second president, who was there at the time, said then and there the child liberty was born. Well, what was it Otis was saying? He was saying no general warrants. In that case, it was a writ of assistance as exercised by the crown against the colonies. And the idea was that this was tyrannical power. And in that case, Otis said, look, this is the worst kind of power you could give the government. This was the experience of Charles I. This was the experience of the Glorious Revolution, and this was George III. He was using a general warrant to collect information and to look for evidence of criminal behavior. So in the Federalist Papers, Hamilton and Madison and John Jay all said we need to separate the powers. And in Federalist 51, Madison said ambition must be made to counter ambition so that you have to align the interests of the man with the office. So we have to offset the Congress against the executive branch, against the judiciary. But in Federalist 51, he goes on to say experience has taught mankind the need of auxiliary precautions. And auxiliary precautions were in the form of separating powers and giving overlapping authority. And foreign affairs is one of those overlapping authorities. Both the president and Congress have foreign affairs authorities in the Constitution. And if Congress wanted to introduce statutes regulating more of Executive Order 12333, it could introduce statutes addressing these new technologies. So we mustn't forget the Federalist Papers and these overlapping authorities and the auxiliary precautions where we do have authority to push back on what the executive branch is doing. Of course, the final auxiliary precaution is the Bill of Rights, where the Fourth Amendment does very clearly lay out that the right to, of the individual against the collection of information with the intent of just looking for evidence of criminality, we have a right to protect it, to be protected against that, because that is the definition of tyranny as the founding generation understood it.
So I disagree almost entirely with what Laura just said, but I actually want to...
You're against the Bill of Rights?
But I'm against the Bill of Rights. I'm really against the Fourth Amendment, and Otis and Madison can go suck eggs for all I care. But I'm actually not going to engage on that point, because I want to focus on the adequacy question that Tom posed. And specifically, I want to suggest that you have to measure adequacy against the alternative. And one of the things that's so troubling in this conversation, not this conversation, but the larger conversation that we've had about the adequacy of the oversight mechanisms, is that really there's not a lot of proposal for what a different, more populist vision of oversight would look like. And so, I mean, I'm actually willing to entertain the idea that the 1978 compromise is not adequate for our contemporary age. But it seems to me that someone who's advancing that proposition, and that proposition is pervasively advanced by, among other things, the press, right, which constantly, you know, talks about the FISA court as a sort of rubber stamp institution and the implication that congressional oversight is meaningless and trivial, I'm actually willing to entertain the idea that these are utterly inadequate mechanisms. But it seems to me that somebody who wants to move beyond them has to propose what the oversight mechanisms that would replace them would look like. And I've actually, you know, I'm not the most crazily well-read person in this area, but I'm not the least either. I've never seen a significant proposal for what intelligence oversight in detail, like what is the version of the 1978 compromise that should be the 2015 compromise? And I think, you know, Laura just did in her opening remarks a little bit of the hard work of sketching that out. But, you know, there's actually remarkably little good work on this out there. That, you know, imagine you said, okay, the intelligence committees are garbage, these inspectors general are silly, and the FISA court are just a bunch of, you know, intelligence officials in robes. Let's build it from scratch. What's the it? What does it look like? And so I will answer the adequacy question by saying, look, I've engaged with the various institutions in question enough that I have a lot of confidence in them, and enough that a reasonable person who doesn't share my political predispositions might reasonably say that I'm a captive apologist for them. They seem adequate to me. But I'm perfectly willing to entertain the idea that we can do better than this structurally. I want to understand what that looks like. I want to compare the existing thing not to some hypothetical, non-existent, non-articulated set of ideas, but to a concrete set of proposals about what intelligence oversight looks like. I've never seen it.
Yeah, I'd just quickly come back on something General Hayden said where we're talking about transparency. You know, I think there's a recognition that more could have been done by these agencies at an earlier time. I mean, if I think of GCHQ, it wasn't so long ago that they even denied they existed. You know, so there's without doubt there's a recognition that some of there has to be an opening up to an extent of some of the work these kind of agencies do. But I think there's a trade-off on that and an obligation for the rest of us, which is that the end result of all these debates, all these calls for the agencies to open up, it may not be more unalloyed transparency. And transparency in this area may not be an unalloyed good. There is going to be, and getting out ahead of the story, the intelligence agencies explain their work, I get it, I understand it, and I think it needs to be done. But I think we, speaking as somebody not in any way part of the intelligence community, obviously, I think we have to accept as a trade-off there are going to be very core things, and that core might actually be pretty big, that these agencies are going to defend, and they're going to defend to the hilt. And so that seems to me to be one of the things that we should bear in mind as we call for more transparency.
You know, Federalist 23 said that the powers for national security have to be unlimited in character, and then Federalist 51 gets to how they divide up that authority among the branches. Let me shift a little bit to what, in your view, have been the secondary and tertiary effects, really, of Snowden and of sort of all the hullabaloo of the last several years about this stuff. Not in terms of counterterrorism, but in terms of how it's affected, in your view, our ability and will affect our ability in future years in relation to, you might say, the growing great power conflict with China and Russia. Laura raised earlier kind of the economic security component, and perhaps you can touch on kind of the interest of NSA to put walls around corporate America, perhaps. But I also want to talk about the degree to which in articulate in going out and talking about the need to monitor various electrons, how much do you think that the conversation has been so diverted or pushed in specifically the CT area that these other things have been neglected in some way?
Okay, I'll start. I do think the government's response to the accusations have been far too counterterrorism focused. All right, it's almost instinctive to pop up with a CT story in defense of anything. This is about, and to be fair, 215 is limited only to counterterrorism purposes. But that's not been the only accusation out there. 702, which is the email program, is broad foreign intelligence. And so you're right. This has a great impact on the nation's ability to collect legitimate foreign intelligence. So to rattle off how have we been hurt? Number one, operationally, unarguably, don't believe the stories coming out of Moscow that, and they have shown no evidence of how this has actually led to yada, yada, yada. You know, we are not going to give you the evidence of who we're not covering anymore, all right? We're not putting that out there. But it has been significant. Second, it has to do with our international relations. And here it's more subtle, not the obvious. It isn't whose cell phone in Berlin we may or may not have been listening to. I understand that there is an unsettling quotient to that reality. But the more long-lasting impact on being able to provide common defense and common security is the inability of foreign intelligence services to believe anything they tell the Americans will ever remain secret. Why would you enter into a discreet relationship with American intelligence services, given our history in terms of the inability to keep such discreet relationships secret? And the third great impact has been on American industry, who've been collateral damage in all of this, for doing nothing more than German industry does for BND, or French industry does for DGSE or DST, or Italian industry does for CISME. It's just the fact that Snowden was an American, and because of the special relationship with four other English-speaking democracies, he's dumped those countries' secrets out there. And American industry has been very unfairly punished by that. And that has a security quotient in terms of the long-term health of American industry, not any kind of gray or dark relationship they may not have had. It has a security impact when American industry is weakened. And then one final thing. Even the former attorney general says, you know, Snowden's got us to a different place and he's prompted a necessary debate. Maybe. He has badly misshaped that debate by the way the information has been put out there by his accomplices. All right. It is very hard to explain what it is we are doing because everyone now thinks NSA is collecting everything on everybody all the time. And so this truly necessary debate has to be done by folks who share a common database. And it is hard to construct that common database now because of the misperceptions created by the way these stories have been rolled out.
Ben, you chimed in?
Yeah, I think that there's another huge effect that's not about German intelligence or French intelligence. It's about Russian and Chinese intelligence. And we have managed to create the worldwide perception that the principal threat to the liberty and privacy of people all over the world is US intelligence. This is a collective delusion at a time when the Chinese are stealing blind IP from all over the world, at a time when nobody can tell you what the rules are under which the Russians take very large quantities of stuff in terms of people's comms, and sometimes release it, by the way. No one can tell you what the rules under which they operate are because there are none. The sense of threat that people have to the integrity of their communications is grotesquely warped. And you have people most afraid of the entities that operate with the most constraints under the real functioning rule of law. And that is a real perversity. And you see it in the European Court of Justice opinion this week, which didn't say, you know, you can't, the safe harbor, you know, agreement with any other country in the world is dead. It said you can't, you know, have a safe harbor agreement with the United States because of NSA. And that is, I think, I don't know if it's a secondary or tertiary or But it is a hugely peculiar set of developments that has implications entirely outside the realm of national security. It has implications in the realm of routine data transfers between countries that are doing business with one another. And so I think the reverberations continue. They continue to be as peculiar and perverse as they were almost from the beginning. And frankly, I think the journalists who broke these stories bear a lot of responsibility for it in terms of the way they characterized U.S. activities relative to the countries that are our adversaries in a lot of the intelligence activity that we engage in, and frankly, in comparison to the activities of a lot of our allies in the intelligence activities in which they engage in.
Well, the effects you just described sound like the effects of an information campaign.
I don't talk about people's motives. I mean, people talk about mine. I don't talk about theirs. I'm describing a set of effects, and you know, a reasonable reader of any major news outlet in this or any other country in the world would have the impression that the NSA is an entity that menaces them. And with a very small number of exceptions, that just isn't true. And they wouldn't have the impression that the FSB or the People's Liberation Army, except to the extent that they have intellectual property to steal with respect to the latter, is something that particularly menaces them. And that actually might not be true. And I think you can look at 100 news stories that are individually may or may not be accurate, but let's assume for the moment that there are no factual errors in the 100 news stories that cumulatively portray a larger picture that's radically untrue. And I think that's a challenge as you move forward in an intelligence reform debate. That's a challenge to the journalists in the room, frankly, to do your job better.
Joe, you got a two-finger, and then Laura.
I just want to make a very, very brief comment. Ben, in his first intervention, talked about the United States now voluntarily extending protections that we had previously reserved only for U.S. persons, now in some way to foreign nationals. I just want to add, we are alone. No one else is doing that.
So I disagree with some of the premises and some of the conclusions. The reason American citizens are so worried about the government is because it is our government. And it is our government that was secretly interpreting the law to mean the exact opposite of what Congress intended when it passed the law. So in Section 215 of the Patriot Act, when it said that the government had to have reasonable grounds to believe that the information being sought, the tangible goods, were relevant to an authorized investigation, and the government secretly interprets this to mean all telephony metadata is potentially relevant to authorized investigations generally, therefore we're just going to collect everything on all U.S. citizens for years and use that information to look for evidence of criminal behavior, that is problematic because the legislation actually didn't say that. So the problem isn't necessarily the Snowden leaks. The problem in that view is our government was secretly interpreting laws to mean the exact opposite of what Congress had intended by putting restrictions on what could be collected. And so what is the cost there? The cost is born in rule of law. The cost, and that is a profound cost for what was happening behind closed doors. That's a profound cost to the country. It's a profound cost, and it is of concern to citizens because our government has access to very coercive tools. Our government has access to the ability to take away our liberty, it can take away our property, it can take away our livelihoods, and it can take our life. And if we don't have rule of law in a society where we know what is being done in our name at the broadest level, I do not mean programmatically every program underway, but if statutes are being interpreted in a way that means the opposite and in a way that both courts and many members of the public have come to see as unconstitutional, then we need to have access to that kind of information. That is what democracy is about. And so I think one of the most profound costs here has been further lack of confidence that what is being done secretly. And that's why the questions that General Hayden referred to earlier are now on the table. What will these structures look like? Because the compromise that we thought we had reached in 1978 did not allow for secret opinions carving out exceptions to the Fourth Amendment, did not allow for secret statutory interpretations, did not allow for a secret body of jurisprudence that would become binding on future judges and look to its precedent in the name of a democracy that didn't even know that that's how the law was being understood.
Yeah, that's a quickly come on.
Yeah,
real quick on Russia. They've used it in a very savvy way, I think. The Russian government has a TV station, runs out of London, called Russia Today. Actually, the organization I work with is in the same office as them, believe it or not. And they have plastered these pictures.
Check all your phones.
Yeah. They have plastered these posters all over London. You see them everywhere. You see them on the tube. It's one around the corner from my flat, saying this is what happens when you don't get a second opinion. And they've gone to town on the Snowden stuff. They put it in their advertising all around London. And it seemed to me that some of the things that were reported on the NSA's activities on Russia, and Ben's website documented this terrifically well, were just outrageous. It was things like, well, the NSA worked with the Norwegian government or the Swedish government to try and get a better idea about Russian energy policy or Russian military policy. And that was tied in with all this debate around metadata and everything. I mean, if that isn't the job of an organization like the NSA, then what is?
Just to come back to the question of secret law, just as a matter of fact and the literal meaning of that word, you need to keep in mind that every member of the oversight committees had full knowledge as to exactly what NSA was doing and under what legal structure they were doing it. In fact, Senator Wyden has been accorded something of a heroic status because of his opposition to what NSA was doing. And the reason he was so frustrated was he was losing the committee vote 13-2. And so the structure set up in the 1970s to kind of in loco rest of Congresses, all right, approve these kinds of secret things, that structure is the one that was used. So the committees were very witting. Beyond that, in both 2009 and 2011, Jim Clapper sent letters to the chairs of the two intelligence committees, intending them to be shared with all members of Congress, saying explicitly, now you know we got all the metadata all the time, domestically and to and from the United States. Now, those were top secret code word documents kept in the two SCIFs of the Senate and the House intelligence committees, and I will accept, as a matter of fact, not many members went to look at them. But the fact of the matter is, the DNI took the extra step beyond what was known by the committee members to let the entire Congress know the broad scope of the program.
Can I just add one tiny little thing? If you wanted to make one reform to the Congressional Intelligence Oversight process that would actually have a really big impact, it would be to make members sign a document acknowledging every briefing they get. Because one thing about our members of Congress, and this is should not be a secret to anybody in the room, they lie. And they lie bald-facedly about what information they have access to. And it would be a wonderful thing if we could have a rule of each committee that when you walk into that SCIF and get a briefing, you sign a receipt. Just an idea.
I thought you were going to say require them to go get some briefing.
Yeah,
right. No. I'm more than happy if Jim Sensenbrenner wants to say publicly, I never went to get briefings because I don't really think that should be part of my job. I'm perfectly happy for him to stand up, and that's between him and his constituents. But when he goes in and gets a briefing, there should be a record of that.
And that's aligning the interest of the member with the to the place. All right. Laura, real quick, and then we'll open it up.
Yeah, I have to say, I've always been kind of mystified by this argument by members. Gosh, what are we supposed to do? Like, first of all, we have to go all the way down to the SCIF, and then we have to, like, read the documents, and then, like, we have to leave the documents there, and then come back. Like, what? Our hands are tied. And you know, when you're renewing legislation, there's another option, which is no. You can vote no on the legislation, right? It's kind of the obvious, you know, but I've always been mystified by this argument.
Absolutely.
I really have been mystified by this argument that they can't. So I share your analysis because the intel agency, but with that said, Two points. 93 members of Congress were prevented from reading the materials by the Intelligence Committee, I will add. 93 members of Congress were told they were not allowed to read the materials. That's a congressional problem. And by the way, CISI has now lifted term limits, so we have some members serving for more than 15 years on the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. Problems of agency capture. There are a lot of small fixes that could be done, not to increase oversight, but improve what oversight ostensibly is already in place, amongst which are actually reading the materials, reading it before you vote on it, and having some term limits on the people serving on these committees to ensure more democratic representation.
These are some good inventions of prudence. This gentleman here had a question, one over here as well.
Okay. Yeah, hi. My name is Todd Rosenblum, and with IBM. I'm a bit of an interested party. I'm a former member of both the intelligence community and of the oversight committees on the Senate side. Life wasn't quite so easy or simple, I think, as I understand the jokes, but it's not quite, I think, as being mentioned right now. So question, we talk about the potential for injury to U.S. persons' privacy rights, and I want to emphasize the potential for injury. I don't believe any courts have found that any government surveillance programs have actually injured any person's privacy. Yet, we live in a world, we're talking about structural reform, when there are countless cases by which we have private company, telecoms, data brokers, etc., repeatedly and continually violating our personal rights, where injury has been documented. We have, for example, terms of agreement that we all are signed, which are not reasonable to expect people to read, that say we forego every single right we have and we will share your information with whomever we want to. So it's a little hard to talk about in the context of how do we sort of look at privacy in a digital era when only talking about what I believe is, and I agree with General Hayden, an extraordinary form of oversight that we have in a world where there are adversaries, there are competitors, and if this was about sort of weapons hardware, this would be sort of such gross negligence of nuclear disarmament we're talking about when we would declare in the Cold War to the Russians, I'll tell you what, we will pull everything we have out of Europe because we just don't sort of like it. We understand you're not going to do anything different.
All right, so the corporate question, go ahead.
So I've often thought that NSA could solve all its problems with an Apple-like click-through agreement. You know, when you do electronic filing of your taxes, you sort of click through all your rights, and that would be the end of it. They'd be operating with consent. That was a joke, by the way. look, there is a peculiarity in the American and international, for that matter, privacy debate, that the perception of threat and the actual threats to people's privacy, as well as the perception of what influences your privacy and the reality of what influences your privacy, are almost unrelated. And so one thing that I think, here are three things that are just grossly overrated in our perceptions of their impact on our privacy. One is the government, one is the law, one is sort of surveillance, espionage in general. And here's some things that are really underrated, which is the sort of common law of your interactions with companies. Whom you give your data to willingly, and what you expect and what they deliver in terms of a kind of iterative conversation that you have with them and you, the collective public, have with them over time. That has a huge impact on your lived experience of privacy every day. What NSA does has virtually none. And I don't say, there's some give in the word virtually there, particularly depending on who you are, and also what you consider to be privacy. Is touching a communication and having it move through a system a privacy violation? So you can have a detailed conversation about this, but the basic common law of your interaction with companies which is much more influenced by the FTC, by the way, than it is by any other government agency. This is just hugely more important than the FBI or NSA. You know, different if you're courting child pornography, different if you're in touch with ISIS. But, you know, this is the gulf between the reality of privacy and the assumed reality of privacy is very, very big. And one thing we have to do is, you know, break that down a little bit and, you know, give people more understanding that their relationship with CVS and True Value Hardware and Target and all the companies that give them little consumer benefit cards, this has a really, really big impact on your privacy relative to anything in law about what NSA or FBI is allowed to do.
Laura, you want to chime in. Maybe you could connect us with the comments you made earlier about the economic security and whether you worry about the databases of Facebook and Apple as being the targets of foreign intelligence.
So, why does privacy matter, right? And it matters in three ways, right? It matters for the intrinsic value of privacy in society, it matters for the potential harms that could be done, and it matters for the structure of the country. And for the latter two categories, the specific harms, you know, to your liberty, to your property, to your life, those are harms that the government can do to you. For the structural issues, the separation of powers, if the executive branch collects all the judge's information, right, there's a structural imbalance that happens. It overrides structural protections. That's a government harm. But the first, the intrinsic value of privacy, that is an aspect of privacy that the commercial sphere does affect. And it affects it in a profound way, in the same way that the government collection of all this affects the intrinsic value of privacy. This is something that Cook wrote about in Dr. Bonham's case, An Englishman's Home is His Castle. Why is it his castle? Because you need to have solitude. It is a human value. It's a human value to have intimate relationships with others and to keep that intimate and private and to have diversity in those intimate relationships. You can decide what level of intimacy you're going to have with others. You can debate ideas in a democracy outside others' gazes. And the basic founding idea or animating idea here is we change our behavior when we are under surveillance, when people are watching what we say and what we do. We change who we are and what we do. And so if we want to be the people we can become, we need solitude, we need debate, we need intimacy in our lives, and those are intrinsic values. This is what Cook wrote about, this is what Hale in his Pleas of the Crown and Hawkins wrote about, Blackstone writes about this. These animating ideas are as true whether it's the government obtaining and guarding this information or others in the commercial sphere aggregating and crunching this information and looking at it. But right now, in a democracy, our way of getting at that is through the government access to that information.
All right, I have time for one more question up here.
Thank you very much. My name is Andrea Glorioso. I am a counselor at the delegation of the European Union to the U.S. here in Washington, D.C. Well, first of all, I would like to say I found this panel extremely interesting and very instructive, and I would commend both CSIS and all the five of you who are sitting there. This is, as I said, very instructive. But having said that, there are two brief points I would like to make because there have been a couple of imprecisions said during the panel, which I think need correcting. And the first is what Benjamin Witte said about the recent ruling of the European Court of Justice invalidating the EU-US Safe Harbor Agreement. And Ben, you raised the point, why didn't the court say anything about Russia or China or agreements? And the court did not say anything on that for one simple reason. That was not the question that the court was asked. The case was about the EU-US Safe Harbor Agreement. The court found that invalid. The European Union does not have an equivalent agreement with China and Russia for very good reasons, I would say. So I think that needs to be clarified. And the second point to General Hayden, I understand that you were referring more to the intelligence community and to how privacy is protected in the intelligence community. I'm not competent to make a comment there, but I will say, on a general basis, right now, U.S. citizens have a right to judicial redress for privacy violations in the European Union. That is not true for European Union citizens in the U.S. So at least when we speak generally about privacy protection, the European Union protects the privacy rights of non-citizens of the European Union. And I say that because you pointed out that due to the recent reforms, there has been an extension of privacy protection intelligence field for non-American citizens. I believe that is correct. But you also said that is not true in any other part of the world. Again, I can't comment on the intelligence war, but more generally, Europe protects the privacy of non-European citizens as well.
So thank you. Let me redirect to the panel as, does the United States have something to learn from Europe?
I'll kick that off. So, number one, just to be clear, I did not mean to suggest that in the Schrems opinion, the court should have addressed a series of questions about countries not before it, or that there should. My point was a more modest one, which was that, you know, the very single-minded European and non-European focus on NSA surveillance at the expense of a lot of other privacy threats in the world shows up in the fact that that litigation exists in the first place, right? That an Austrian national's response to that is to bring a litigation in Ireland that ends up in the European Court of Justice and strikes down the entire safe harbor agreement.
I'm sorry, I don't want to enter into a confrontation on this. Let's read them out, because you had a customer of an American company which wanted their data. I'm sorry.
I appreciate your precision, but let us again be clear. That case came up not because European authorities were against the U.S., not because we have an axe to grind with U.S. authorities. We don't. We should always keep in mind that we are the two closest allies in this world, and our economic exchanges are the strongest in this world. And in this debate, we should keep that in mind. In that specific case, you had a European consumer of an American company which requested the American company to remove its data. Yeah, but we cannot. We have to be precise. If we want to discuss, we have to discuss on the facts.
Okay.
So I just one brief in response to Tom's question. I think the United States has a lot to learn from Europe, and it's mostly by negative example, frankly. There is a reason why Silicon Valley is in Silicon Valley and not in Europe, and a lot of it has to do with differences in data rules and just the degree to which European rules stifle innovation. And I actually am much more comfortable with the American approach to data, which is a more permissive, proactive approach to the use of data, combined with, you know, strong enforcement from the FTC and statutory rules regarding interaction with intelligence community than I am to the European approach to it. And I know Americans are supposed to be sort of shamefaced about how we're the Wild West and with respect to data, and Europe is the living under the rule of law. That's not the way I see it.
All right, let the other members.
So to the other half of the question, it is true. In terms of the American kind of broad theological view towards permissible and impermissible surveillance, we're kind of Manichaean about the world. You know, it's a very binary thing. You are or you are not protected by the Fourth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. All right, and I freely admit my European friends have a broader, I would say, softer, maybe fuzzier around the edge, not nearly as crisp, certainly not as binary, of a broad human right with regard to privacy, where ours is truly tied to national identity. Beyond that, though, I think the European Union has a structural issue that, since we're commenting on friends, I'll share my view. Questions of privacy, the question that was resolved between the Irish and the Austrians and the European Court, you have divided issues of sovereignty between the community and the nations, and you have given an awful lot of authority to the community to make decisions, but not about national security. National security decisions have been reserved to the nations. And so what you have in the European Union dialogue is, I frankly think, a very stilted dialogue in which the voices for security are just not there. They just don't exist. Whereas in our dialogue, we get into a knife fight because we've got the arguments for privacy over here and the arguments for security over here inside the same institutional environment. And so what you end up with is a very broad and, frankly, admirable European view towards this broad human right. And then after Charlie Hebdo, you have the French Parliament passing laws that would never see the light of day in the United States when it comes to domestic espionage.
Robin, both UK and European.
Yes, as resident European, it should be upon me to defend the European Union's honor, shouldn't it? I don't know. I tend to think that I agree with General Hayden, and even before Charlie Hebdo, really, in terms of some of the oversight in European on the European side of this. I mean, look at what you can do in France with a general warrant, and compare the oversight and the I mean, I think three people, possibly a presidentially appointed panel, look at this and can approve huge amounts of things that I think wouldn't fly in it from the United States point of view. So. I guess my plea would be that if the perception is in the U.S. that the European Union is there's too much focus on privacy over security and the rest of it, would be that the U.S. should then take the lead in making that point and trying to bring the European Union round to the American point of view. I think there's been generally, not just on this issue, but a whole range of issues, a lack of U.S. leadership in recent years. And I suppose it's easier for me to say that than an American to say that there should be more US leadership on this. And I would say that on surveillance, but a whole host of international issues.
Well, final comment from Laura.
Just on General Hayden's point on the Fourth Amendment not touching foreigners, it does under Verdugo-Urquidez. So there's this case, Verdugo-Urquidez, where Chief Justice Rehnquist says that foreigners who lack a substantial connection to the United States don't have the protection of the Fourth Amendment. And his reasoning is that the language of the Fourth Amendment, the right of the people to be secure in their persons, papers, houses, and effects against unreasonable search and seizure, he says, look, the right of the people is the people that we have in the Constitution, we the people of the United States in the beginning of the Constitution. And so the people in the Fourth Amendment refers only to the people of the United States, unless you have a substantial connection. And so one argument that's been circulated is, well, foreigners using American ISPs have a substantial connection to the United States. This strikes me as a very bad idea, because then any bad guy or bad girl, let's not be gendered, right, any bad girl overseas can use an American ISP and then immediately gain the protections of the Fourth Amendment in this kind of instrumentalist sense. And I think that goes directly against the country's foreign intelligence and interests overseas. Foreign intelligence interests. So there is just a little proviso on that. That in fact, if you have a substantial connection to the United States, you'll be happy to hear, Robin, that you would be extended protections of the Fourth Amendment. But those who lack a substantial connection fall outside the contours of the Fourth.
Well, thank you all for your very passionate and expert expert thoughts about this, and thank you for coming out, and all of you as well.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks this week to CSIS for giving us permission to use this audio. Our music, as always, is performed by Sophia Yan, and please spread the word and promote the Lawfare Podcast via your social networks on Twitter, Facebook, email, and in any other way you can. Thanks for listening.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.